The hour of 1 o'clock is here, and I will call the meeting of the Ag Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. Welcome, everybody. It's good to have all of us here around the same table. And the kind of a first meeting, we'll do a little bit of housekeeping and then go on with a couple of interesting presentations we have for us today. In your packet, you have a copy of the committee rules. Nothing I don't think would jump out at you. One correction in the rules on the very first line. You're all here, so the room is G3, not G35. So make that correction in your committee rules. And you know, we may have to, in a few weeks, make some corrections or changes to the rules if the committee ship chairs change, things like that. So again, these will be a document that could be modified as we move along. But again, thanks for all being here. I think to kind of get going today, let's do some introductions. We always like to do that. First committee meeting. Let's go around the table and briefly, your name, your district, where you're from, and how about, being this as ag, your favorite food and what the connection you may have or your district may have to agriculture. Let's start with Chair Hansen.
So I have to pick a food right away. My name is Rick Hansen. I represent South St. Paul, part of Inver Grove, Newport, St. Paul Park, part of Cottage Grove, and part of Gray Cloud Island Township. I've been in the legislature for 20 years. I grew up on a farm in Freeborn County, where I still farm in partnership with my brother, and then I also have a farm in Fillmore County, which I drove up from this morning. Favorite food? I like pumpkin pie. I guess it's not the season for that. I guess just the thing I'm hearing, you know, my district is not a lot of farms. It does have some in Gray Cloud Island Township, but I have a lot of consumers. And, you know, what I hear from them is concerns about the price of eggs and the cost of things and availability of things. And, you know, I think those are looking at from the consumer side as well as the production side is really an important thing. So pleased to be here.
Hello, I'm Luke Frederick. I represent the Mankato Area District 18B, Mankato, Eagle Lake, and Skyline. Second term on the Ag Committee. This is my third term in the legislature. Looking forward to the conversations this year. I think it's going to be an interesting year in that we are seeing spaces across the state, across the country, already being impacted by policies coming out of the Trump administration. We just saw some of the impacts coming over the weekend in agriculture, and I think that it is going to be the job of this committee to do the best that we can to support Minnesota farmers across the state, and it's going to be unique that I think we are going to have to be more reactive this year than we've ever been before. Favorite food would be probably pizza, because you can have breakfast pizza and dessert pizza and regular pizza. And I'm also a subscriber that Casey's gas station is not a gas station. It's a pizza joint that just happens to sell gas.
Thank you. My name is Esther Agbaje. I'm a state representative covering a district that covers parts of downtown Minneapolis and parts of North Minneapolis. It's my third term in the legislature, my first term on the Agriculture Committee. Very much interested in learning more about our food policy, how we can support our urban farmers, as well as getting a better sense of understanding land use and regenerative policies for farming. My favorite food, I'll take it back a little culturally, I guess. We have a yam porridge in Nigeria known as asharo, and it's really good. It's got like yam, it's got tomatoes, it's got palm oil, really bright flavors, and so I think that's one of my favorite dishes.
Right. Hello, everyone. I'm Samantha Vang. I represent Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park area. That's a northwest suburban area. And this is how many terms have I been on this committee? Ever since I've been elected in 2018. So I've always been a member of the Ag Committee, former Ag Chair as well. And my favorite food, that's a very hard question, but if I have to name one, it will be a typical Hmong pepper sauce, which is consists of Thai chili peppers and herbs and fish sauce. So anything spicy, I love it.
Good afternoon, everyone. Fu Lee, serving my fifth term. This is my first time serving in ag, so really I'm excited to work with our chairs and, you know, all the members of the committee. I think, you know, one of the big issues, and Representative Bajay mentioned this, you know, in our area, urban ag, you know, a lot of interest, and so really excited to work with all of you to see how we can make that happen. Myself, for favorite food, rice noodle pho, beef noodle soup, and I think that's something that all of us can enjoy.
Good afternoon, Representative Andy Smith. I represent District 25B, which is downtown Rochester and the surrounding areas. I'm a small business owner. My wife and I run a used bookstore, and as many farmers have told me, they are also small business owners, so we have that in common as well. Happy to be here. This is my first time on agriculture, and honestly, when I came into the legislature 4 years ago, this is not an area that I knew a whole lot about, but I learned very quickly that southern Minnesota has very deep roots in agriculture, and that my constituents, even in an urban slash suburban area, were very connected and needed representation here. So glad to be here. Now, my favorite food, probably be smart. I'll say corn, soybeans, turkeys, chicken, and anything else that is represented in this room.
Oh, that's smooth. That's good. You should only pick one. Anyway, good to hear you, meet you all. I'm Representative Anderson. This is my ninth term here, and you may have heard that I'm the senior member. Some say oldest, but I prefer senior member of the Minnesota House. I live, 150 miles northwest of here, up in the Alexandria, Glenwood, Starbuck area, Benson area, and I farm, raise corn, soybeans, and a little bit of wheat. Used to raise cattle, but our kids have all left home now. And that's a lot of work to work livestock. Ag is extremely important. We've all said that. A lot of things, a lot of uncertainties happening right now, but we hope to work through those. And I would like to really concentrate on making sure our state is prepared and ready in case there's any outbreaks of additional livestock diseases in our herds of chickens, turkeys, dairy, hogs, cattle, whatever. So welcome, and we'll go down the row here. We'll also get to our staff here in just a minute, but let's go down to Vice Chair Hart.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Bobby Harder, and this is my second term. I represent most of Sibley County and then about one half of Carver County and the eastern part of McLeod County. My favorite food, I'm going to say, is a macaroni and cheese. I grew up poor, and so every time when I do eat macaroni and cheese, it reminds me of how far I have come from the days of poverty, if you want to call it that. My connection to ag is that my husband and I, we are farmers, and we grow corn and soybeans. And so our corn, if you eat corn or if you eat eggs, think of Harder's, because our corn goes to the chicken facility, and then our soybeans go, I don't know where, on a barge by CHS. So I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Representative Steve Jacob. My connection to agriculture is I am a fourth generation family farmer, and we have farmed everything from sheep to dairy to crop farm. And so we've kind of had all different aspects of agriculture in our family. My district is in the Rochester-Winona area. So Winona County, Olmsted, Wabasha, and Goodhue counties are all in my district. And then my favorite food, I would have to say, is sirloin. It's delicious.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Representative John Burkle from District 1A, Northwest Minnesota. It'd be Roseau, Kitson, Marshall, Pennington counties. I'm a fourth generation turkey producer. We own a group of us own a turkey marketing cooperative up in Thief River Falls. Minnesota being the number one turkey producing state, I think it's safe to say that turkey is my favorite food. And beyond that, main interest going into this session, as Chair Anderson alluded to, with disease, bird flu, whatnot, going on in our animal egg industry. Very important to me to see the Board of Animal Health, and it's fully funded and able to do the job to help prevent disease in Minnesota. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Rep. Steve Gander. This is my first term, so first time on this committee. In my day job, I'm an optometrist, so you might say, what are you doing here? Well, my dad came off a dairy farm in Wisconsin. My mom grew up on a farm around Newfoundland, Minnesota. We do still have some farmland up there that we manage and keep track of. Also know how very important agriculture is to our whole state, our whole region. If you go up into northwestern Minnesota, 1B, so I have the southern half of that Senate District 1. Agriculture up there is our economic base. Everything seems to kind of flow off of that. So I'm happy to be here. Oh, my favorite food, pizza. Any kind of pizza. There's no bad pizza. I remember back in school, the pizza ingredients looked more like a chemistry set, but I still ate it. So nowadays we have real ingredients. It's better. Probably Canadian bacon mushroom would be my first choice. Thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Lawrence, and this isn't my first term, but it's not my second term either. I was sworn in on April 2nd last spring, and so I get to come in. This is my first time being on the Agriculture Committee, and really thrilled to be here. I represent House District 27B. That is the areas of Princeton, Zimmerman, and St. Francis. Quite a bit of agricultural farm ground in that area as well, still to this day. I come from a family farm. We raise Kentucky bluegrass sod as well as Hereford cattle. And so my favorite food would be beef, and that would be whether it's the sirloin, the hamburger, or the ribs that go along with it. So that would be my favorite food. And just really looking forward to be able to serve on this agriculture committee, given my background and my family roots being in agriculture. So thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Nathan Nelson from 11B, serving parts of Chisago, Kanabec, and Pine County. I'm a farmer by trade. I've got some cattle, grow corn and soybeans, and some hay. Agriculture is a pretty big part of the district, and we've got probably a little disproportionate showing of agriculture in this room. We got the Commissioner of Agriculture lives in the district that I represent. There's a few others on the committee, or kind of staff and whatnot, that are from the Pine County as well, so it's kind of neat. It's a powerhouse in agriculture, I guess. So my favorite food is a ribeye, and it's good for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or a midnight snack. So if you work with cattle, you realize why you eat them. So
thank you all. Good comments. I think I forgot to mention my favorite food, and coming off of Super Bowl, my favorite food has got to be wings. Those that go out to dinner with me know I love wings, so that would be my favorite. Let's get some staff folks in here around the table. Start with to my left here, and staff, please tell us who you are and your background a little bit.
My name is Mark Nicely. I'm the Republican Caucus Committee Administrator, working with Chair Anderson and all of you to help ensure a smooth functioning of the committee. My favorite food is whatever I'm cooking in the backyard at the time. But there's probably nothing better than perfectly smoked beef short ribs.
Hi, my name is Peter Strohmeyer. I'm the DFL Committee Administrator for Ag, and my favorite food is prime rib.
My name is Jean Coddington, and I'm just filling in today. My favorite food is a Cobb salad.
My name is Megan Mullenbeck. I'm the House Research Analyst, and my favorite food is chocolate chip banana bread.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ken Sabry. I'm the nonpartisan fiscal analyst for the committee, and my favorite food is clam chowder.
A couple additional staff on the sides. Do you want to stand up, say who you are, and your favorite food?
I am Sean Haydorn, DFL Research, and my favorite food is beef stew with biscuits.
Luke LeBron, GFE Research, and I'm a big wings guy.
I'm Tim Walker with the Nonpartisan House Public Information Service. I use that right for Session Daily.
Is that everybody?
I love crispy, deep fried
pages in the room or not. Okay.
Well, thanks, everybody. Do we have any pages in the room? Maybe. How's the tone? Oh, go ahead. Very good. Thanks, everybody. Hope we didn't miss anybody. If we did, we'll get you next time. Let's turn now to our agenda. I have a couple of really, I think, important topics to discuss today. One pertains to sustainable aviation fuel, and the other concerns a dairy situation here in Minnesota. So first up, we're going to be discussing the acronym is SAF, Sustainable Aviation Fuel. And first up to testify on the topic is somebody from the State Department of Agriculture. So state your record and begin your testimony, and welcome.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Andrea Vobel, and I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you so much for holding this hearing and giving us the opportunity to speak on it. It's something I could talk about all day, but I will be very brief because I know that you've got a lot of really great folks here to testify in support. So the Walz Flanagan administration is extremely excited about the opportunities that SAF presents for our agricultural, forestry, and clean energy sectors here in Minnesota. We are very grateful to your support and many others who were able to pass the SAF tax credit during the 2023 legislative session. So the tax credit that you all passed was designed to stack on top of federal IRA tax credits for SAF production and give us, Minnesota, a competitive advantage to attract producers and blenders to the state. It is a nation-leading tax credit. It's refundable and eligible to SAF producers and blenders at $1.50 per gallon. For any SAF producer blended in the state between July 1st of 2024 and June 30th of 2030. We also passed a sales tax and use exemption for materials, supplies, and equipment used in the construction or improvement of a SAF production facility, and that is effective until July 1st of 2030 as well. You all, along with Governor Walz, have supported the tax credit effort at $11.6 million, and you will see in the governor's current budget that there's additional investment for this effort, as well as some slight changes related to a premium for a lower CI score. You'll hear more about what SAF is and why the CI score matters, but it's something we're really proud of and excited to keep talking about this session. Minnesota has plenty of feedstocks ready to go. We know that we're going to need everything and anything that's available to meet the demand. And as you've heard, or as you will hear, the demand far exceeds the supply, and we're going to need everything and anything. We're thinking in the short and near term as more innovation spurs new pathways and technology. Companies across the country continue to look to Minnesota and our food and ag sectors for investments in innovation, and it's important we continue investing in our nation-leading tax credit so companies know that Minnesota is where they should be making their home. We can grow a thriving SAF industry in Minnesota that supports farmers and foresters, creates jobs with family-sustaining wages, and supports Minnesota's rural economy through bio-industrial innovation. Thank you so much again for the time. Happy to take any questions as well after you hear from testifiers.
Thank you, Ms. Bobble. Any questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, thank you. Next testifier is Jeff Davidman from Delta Airlines, and he has somebody with him as well. So welcome to the testifiers table. Identify yourselves for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Jeff Davidman with Delta Airlines. Been with the company for about 20 years, and I can honestly say this is my first time in the Agriculture Committee as an airline guy. But it's sort of where we've spending our time for the last couple years. We found ourselves in new spaces and talking to new stakeholders as we think about sustainable aviation fuel and how excited we are about this opportunity and how we're going to need everybody in the value chain to try and solve this problem. Aviation is a hard-to-decarbonize industry. Unlike other forms of transportation, there aren't electric planes expected for flights to places like from Minneapolis to Chicago or New York or London or Tokyo for 70 to 75 years from now. But Delta has still made a commitment to get to net zero by 2050. And although there are things that we can do when on the ground, such as remove single-use plastics from our aircraft, which we're doing, you'll see if you fly Delta this year, new paper cups rolling out, or electrifying all the possible equipment on the ground, such as our tugs that push the planes back or our baggage loaders at the gates. our carbon footprint, more than 90% of our carbon footprint really comes from what occurs in the air, and so that's what we need to look at. And the best tool that we as Delta, and actually the entire airline industry in the U.S. and globally has found, is that at our disposal to reach our goal of getting to net zero is sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF. In fact, we believe that SAF will make up about 60% of our efforts to get to our net zero goal, not just as Delta, but as the airline industry as a whole. And that's not just Delta saying that. As I said, the United States 2021 Aviation Climate Action Plan highlights that SAF will be critical to the long-term decarbonization of aviation. The International Civil Aviation Organization, which is global, has adopted a long-term goal for SAF as one of the most important levers to reach our net zero goals by 2050. The IPCC has highlighted that use of SAF is the best lever to decarbonize the aviation industry in its sixth assessment report in 2023. And other parts of the world, the EU, the UK, have put in mandates for SAF. And other parts of the world, like Japan and Australia and elsewhere, are looking at different SAF policies as well. But in addition to the climate benefits, as Deputy Commissioner Vauble was saying, there are tremendous significant opportunities to enhance our country's energy independence and spur significant economic development opportunities right here in Minnesota, and that's what we're focused on doing. So as way of background, what is SAF? Well, in order for fuel to be classified as SAF, it must at a minimum achieve a 50% carbon emissions reduction over the life cycle of the fuel when compared to conventional jet fuel. So a minimum of a 50% reduction. But we know some feedstocks can result to up to an 80% reduction as well. SAF is a drop-in fuel. So what that means is today we can take 50% SAF and we can blend that with 50% conventional jet fuel, and it works in our infrastructure. It works in our planes, it works with our engines, and it works at MSP Airport and other airports and all the infrastructure that we have in place. Today, it's certified by ASTM, it's certified by the FAA. We are using it. In fact, last year we used about 12 million gallons of SAF in our flights during the year. So we know it works today. We also expect, as we continue to work with manufacturers like Airbus and Boeing, engine manufacturers like Pratt Whitney, GE, and others, that blend rate is just going to keep going higher and higher. So if it's 50-50 today, we know that's going to go to a 60% blend rate, 70%, and so on and so forth as we go forward. In fact, just last year, our partner Virgin Atlantic flew a 100% flight of SAF flight from London to JFK successfully. And we're learning a tremendous amount from that data that we learned from that flight. Although the industry and technology are still being developed, what's really exciting is that we know Minnesota is home to many of the feedstocks that can be used to make SAF, including used cooking oil, corn, soybeans, cover crops such as camelina, which is actually what we used for our first flight using SAF out of MSB this past September, municipal solid waste, forestry waste, clean hydrogen, and more. The problem is, at present, there isn't enough annual production of SAF to fuel the world's airlines for even one full week. And what does exist is very expensive, about 2 to 5 times the cost of conventional jet fuel. The U.S. airline industry, including Delta, uses about 30 billion gallons of conventional jet fuel every year. Delta's share of that is about 4 billion gallons. 30 billion for the U.S. industry, 50 billion gallons if you think about how much is used worldwide. The U.S. industry, including Delta, has made a commitment to replace 10% of our conventional jet fuel that the industry uses with SAF by 2030. That's about 3 billion gallons for all U.S. carriers. So we need to get to 3 billion gallons by 2030. In 2022, 25 million gallons of SAF were produced in the world. 2023, we did a little bit better, 140 million gallons of SAF was produced. In 2024, we did a little bit better, 370 million gallons. But what we need to get to by the end of the decade is 3 billion gallons. And as we think about the demand going farther, as that blend rate continues to increase, and as we look at this from a global solution, we're talking, you know, tens of billions of gallons of SAF that's going to be needed to meet the world's demand. Delta's goal is to make MSP, our second largest hub in the world, where we use approximately 270 million gallons of fuel every year, the first airport in our network in which we can say every single airplane that departs MSP has SAF on board. And our hope is we can say that SAF was made from Minnesota feedstock, made here in Minnesota. Excuse me. Thank you to the bipartisan support in the Minnesota legislature and Governor Walz. The state of Minnesota in 2023 passed a SAF tax credit that has put Minnesota in a position to lead in the development of the SAF industry, not just in the region, but globally. Minnesota has taken the lead, but we're not alone. Illinois has passed a SAF tax credit. The state of Washington has passed a SAF tax credit. The state of Nebraska last year passed a SAF tax credit. And the state of Colorado has done something for construction of SAF facilities. So it was a great first step in 2023, but other states are looking at this opportunity as well. In Minnesota, the SAF tax credit led to the launching of the Minnesota SAF Hub in 2023, which is a first-of-its-kind public-private partnership aimed towards building the value chain to scale the SAF economy from farm to plane, all in Minnesota. People are looking at this across the globe. We think as we look at the value chain, it can all be done right here in Minnesota. And with that, I'm going to turn this over, Mr. Chair, with your permission, to Peter Frosch from Greater MSP, who's leading the efforts of the Minnesota SAF Hub.
Welcome, Mr. Frosch, to the committee. And again, state your name and proceed for the record.
Mr. Chair, we're going to try to get plugged in here, and I'm just proceed while my colleague works on this. Good afternoon. My name is Peter Frosch. I am the CEO of the Greater MSP Partnership. Greater MSP is a public-private partnership, a 501c3 that works like a co-op, which I think is a fair comparison in this committee. Instead of having members we serve or represent, Greater MSP is made up of a very diverse set of 350 different investors and partners who choose to come together, despite their differences, to pursue one shared mission, to grow the economy of the Minneapolis-St. Paul region and the state so we have more great jobs for all residents. This partnership involves big companies, universities, cities, counties, foundations, and the state of Minnesota. The state is an important partner for Greater MSP in many ways, but does not fund Greater MSP. Greater MSP is leading many significant efforts to grow Minnesota's economy today, including Minnesota MedTech 3.0, the Minnesota CHIPS Coalition, MBOLD, which is about global food and agriculture, and the Minnesota SAF Hub. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about the opportunity Minnesota has with SAF, which is an opportunity to create tens of thousands of good jobs across the state, add new revenue for Minnesota agricultural producers, attract billions of dollars in private investment from around the world, and renew our state's reputation as a place that is capable of solving some of the world's hardest problems. So we see Delta's big challenge with SAF as a big opportunity for Minnesota. Building a SAF economy is part of our region's economic growth strategy, the plan for how and where we will compete in the national and global economy. As Jeff said, SAF is a must-have solution for every airline in every country in the world, but no place in the world has figured out how to create a SAF industry at scale. And that's because SAF is a puzzle with three pieces. First, you need to be able to produce it in large volumes to satisfy demand. You need to make SAF that it's not SAF unless it's at least half the carbon of regular jet fuel. And it has to be at a price that customers are willing to pay. And no place has figured out yet how to accomplish all three. There is a global race to be first, and I'm excited to say that we in Minnesota today are near the front of the pack. And we're among the leaders in this global race for three reasons. One, we've created a smarter, faster approach for solving this very complex problem. Two, the partners we have involved are among the best in the world. And three, Minnesota is a great place to build a SAF economy because of the assets we have. We have a large airport with over 400 million gallons of annual fuel demand. We have a robust corporate community that's committed to cleaner travel to help us build and buy SAF. We have a deep research assets in our universities, and we are rich with agricultural inputs, and soon other inputs like green hydrogen from which SAF can be made. Building a SAF industry in Minnesota will create very significant economic value for many communities across the state. We just refreshed an independent economic analysis of what it would look like to build the first three SAF biorefineries in Minnesota, each of which are estimated to produce about 50 million gallons of SAF. Building those three SAF facilities would generate an estimated 55,000 construction job years. And in the first 10 years of operation, those three facilities would create an estimated 40,000 full-time jobs in operation and supplying the facilities across the state. In the first 10 years, these three facilities would cut global carbon emissions by about 15.5 million metric tons. These are all preliminary, but also conservative estimates. These numbers could more than double because we want to build more than three facilities in various places across the state. Right now, Greater MSP is working with over a dozen potential SAF producers around the country and the world, companies who are considering investing billions of dollars to make SAF in Minnesota. The potential inputs that we're working with these companies to make SAF out of Minnesota include agriculture waste, forestry waste, urban wood waste, biogas from animal agriculture, corn, soybeans, green hydrogen, regenerative agriculture crops like winter camelina, and even CO2 itself. Technically, every one of these inputs can produce SAF that meets that 51% carbon threshold. Some of these inputs get us to 75%. Some are actually carbon neutral, 100% carbon reduction. The Minnesota SAF Hub strategy aims to make SAF out of most, if not all, of these inputs after 2030, so that our SAF economy is creating jobs from the tarmac of MSP Airport to the borders of the state. I'll conclude by introducing how we are doing all this, and my fellow panelists will go deeper. To realize this opportunity, Greater MSP built and launched an effort called the Minnesota SAF Hub. The SAF Hub isn't an organization or a program. It is a public-private partnership with a single goal and a shared strategy. It's a complex, fast-paced, problem-solving effort. If you can see to my previous kind of point about the possibility of producing SAF in different parts of the state from different inputs, when we talk about building a SAF economy in Minnesota, this is kind of the big idea, that we could have multiple facilities in different parts of the state making SAF out of different inputs, creating jobs and supplier networks in different parts of the state. The first project announced late last year, a company called DG Fuels indicated they wanted to build a $5 billion plant near Moorhead to make 193 million gallons of SAF out of agricultural waste. So this is becoming real. But just to give you a sense of how we're thinking about this, the team, and that's really what the hub is, it's a team of big companies and environmental groups and universities and more all working together. And the team includes the state of Minnesota. You see the state's logo on this page. As referenced, in 2023, the legislature acted to create the nation's best incentive for blending and producing SAF, and that action came at exactly the right moment. And without that action, I don't believe that we would be here today. The hub is built on a shared ambition. We wrote down in the beginning what we are all working to achieve. We are building an industrial-scale value chain to produce SAF anchored in Minnesota, to deliver affordable, low-carbon SAF to the airport with a view to eventually produce potentially billions of gallons a year. Shared success in achieving this is going to produce a lot of good things for a lot of different entities. We developed a strategy to achieve this. There's some detail that's hard to read from where you're sitting, but the big idea is it has three horizons. Step one, we want to get SAF to MSP Airport as soon as we can. Step two, we want to make SAF at scale in Minnesota. And step three, we want to make a lot more SAF in Minnesota from a lot more inputs, push down the price, and make the carbon score even better. We are well on our way in this strategy, which has been operating for a couple of years, and we're closing in on completing the first phase. This hub is about action and results. We don't have committees that govern. We have teams that solve and lead, and it's different than anything exists in the country, and it is working. In 2024, we achieved four major milestones. A blending facility is now being constructed near the airport so that we can get SAF made anywhere in and around Minnesota into the airport. We create a private demand consortium with national companies who are paying very significant additional dollars to purchase the first 15 million gallons of SAF. We achieved the first flight at MSP Airport last September with SAF made from Minnesota-grown winter camelina, and then the announcement from DG Fuels last fall. In 2025, we're on to our next set of problems to solve. We are aiming to secure a second refiner that would produce SAF in Minnesota before 2030. We want to add more private companies to this demand consortium to increase demand. We're now working with the state to add matching dollars to that incentive and ensure that the state's permitting process allows us to build refineries in Minnesota rather than surrounding states. And we're working on a 1-million-acre study for winter camelina that will show us how to get from where we are now, which is just a few thousand acres, to 1 million acres. The agricultural leaders involved in this effort say once we can get to 1 million, it can scale to 3 or 5 from there. And power, you know, Minnesota is a national leader on regenerative agriculture. So we're making fast progress in this complex problem-solving effort because the hub is made of amazing committed organizations and because the leaders you're going to talk to today. Thank you for your attention and interest in this significant economic opportunity. I welcome comments and questions after others have concluded. Or now, if that is your preference.
Mr. Frosch, thank you very much for your testimony. A remarkable project you have on the drawing board, and actually it's coming to fruition as well. So thank you very much for your testimony. Anybody have any questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is for Mr. Davidman, too. You know, and we have discussed before of integrity is very important. And so how do you actually quantify sustainability, the adjective that is the one that matters?
Right. One answer.
Mr. Frosch, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. You know, I think as Jeff and others would explain, the market here is about decarbonization, so that is the point. And so there has to be a clear, transparent, you know, rigorous and sustained way to measure where the carbon is. There is a national model called GREET, which was developed by the U.S. Department of Energy, that in the United States is the standard. Europe uses a slightly different model. One of the priorities for the SAF Hub this year is to bring national leaders together around that question, because we're frankly so far ahead of where some other places are that we need this answer more than others do. And there are questions like, how do we account for water quality? How do we account for kind of biodiversity? All of those are important outcomes that we not only need to track, but we need to manage for. And we in Minnesota don't have the ability to create our own measurement for this, but we need the United States, if not globally, to have a standard, transparent way to measure that. So part of what the hub is going to do this year is provide some national leadership in pushing that question and kind of showing what we need to make this work. We need to be able to work with these potential SAF producers and run their data through the same equation that everybody else goes through, so everyone can see what the carbon reduction looks like. So it's an important question. It's top priority this year.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, the GREET model doesn't include fertilizer inputs or water quality impacts. It just looks at the sustainability kind of from production on. You know, I think we often get to self-attestation in terms of, did I do this, in terms of production of various things or different practices. I think independent third-party validation of sustainability is really critical, rather than models or in-lab research being applied to scale. Because I think if we're going to have massive public investment into this, as well as the private sector, it better be what it says it is.
Any further questions from members? If not, thank you, Mr. Frosch, and hang around if there could be questions later on. Please be available. Next up, Amanda Billick, Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Great. Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Amanda Billick. I'm the Senior Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. We represent about 7,000 Minnesota family farmers who grow corn. As you've already heard, SAF is a safe, fully certified jet fuel that can be used in today's aircraft engines and transported via existing pipeline infrastructure. Also, as you've already heard, SAF can be produced from many feedstocks, including corn, and because this can help to reduce the life cycle emissions for aviation fuel. Corn-based ethanol is a good fit for SAF production. It's in the alcohol-to-jet pathway, and that's because we have an abundance of already produced corn-based ethanol, so it's affordable, it's abundant, and we have this existing infrastructure all across greater Minnesota communities. So we are optimistic that this could be a new value-added market for corn, but we're also clear-eyed about some of the challenges that exist to help commercialize this technology. So to meet the airline's SAF goals, different technology pathways and feedstocks will be needed. It's kind of an all-of-the-above type of effort. I want to also emphasize that we do think that corn utilization for SAF could come from existing corn production acres that already exist in Minnesota and would not need new acres. That is because each year the efficiency of corn production on those existing acres increases about 2.2 bushels per year, and that's really due to the improved agronomics. Another factor in corn utilization is potential increased demand in existing uses of corn, such as liquid fuel consumption or exports. So given the domestic production potential of SAF, it could provide an avenue to help with like a longer-term market challenge that corn farmers are facing. Minnesota Corn is a part of the Minnesota SAF Hub, along with several other organizations. And we are really committed to the mission of the Hub to help create a scalable model for SAF production in Minnesota. The initial establishment of SAF production does require significant capital investment, and state and federal tax credits, as you've already heard, play a really important role in the overall financing package. Accelerating SAF development in Minnesota will also require consistency, predictability, and efficiency in our environmental permitting system. The Minnesota SAF tax credit and the federal 45Z clean fuel tax credit do have carbon intensity requirements for eligibility. So any agricultural feedstock for SAF is really just one part of the overall life cycle carbon intensity score. But carbon reductions in feedstock can really help to lower that CI for the overall finished clean fuel product. So at the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, corn farmer leaders have been working to fill some of the different data gaps that exist to help describe today's efficient production of modern agriculture practices. So we worked with Eocene Environmental Group to evaluate the soil, water, and carbon impacts of various corn production practices. So in your packets is a handout really summarizing some of the outcomes from this sustainability assessment. I also want to highlight in particular that in 2023, nearly 39,000 acres were assessed, representing these acres were farmed by the board members of Minnesota Corn. So if I can refer you specifically to page 4, which is on the back side, the last page of your pack of your handout, we did, and working with the consultant, we took the farm level data that was already collected through these broader sustainability assessments and actually ran that data through the GREET model, which you've heard about already this morning, but just the feedstock production intensity calculator. So it was found that when farm level data is used in the model and aggregated across the corn acres in the assessment, the feedstock production practices reduced the carbon intensity of that feedstock by 31% compared to the average values that were in the model. These reductions were driven by efficient fertilizer applications and the use of manure as a source of nitrogen. So the previous question had asked about if fertilizer was factored into the GREET model, and in the feedstock production calculator, fertilizer applications, rates, timing are all included in that calculator. So this assessment shows that when you use real-world farm-level data of the current production practices, corn can be a valuable, low-cost, and abundant feedstock for SAF production. We're encouraged by the potential market opportunity for SAF in Minnesota, and we recognize that there are challenges to overcome, but we look forward to working with a diverse set of partners to address those challenges. Thank you for having this hearing and looking forward to the discussion and the opportunity to share our perspective. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Billick. Questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, for about 10, 12 years, we've had Forever Green come in front of the legislature and ask for money for alternative crops and focusing on winter camelina or other things and talk about sustainable aviation fuel as an end source. But when I see 8.6 million acres of corn growing in Minnesota, this is really about corn, isn't it?
Is that a question? Ms. Billick.
Yeah, well, so Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I would say that we see it as being one part, that in order to meet those commitments that the airlines have set, really all technologies, all feedstocks are going to be needed if the airlines are going to achieve those commitments. So we see corn as hopefully being one part of it, but not the entire part by any means.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned permitting, and so in streamlining permitting, I think there's going to be a discussion in another committee later this week. But as part of the carbon reduction CO2 pipeline, moving that to North Dakota for fracking? Ms. Billick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that does factor into the life cycle assessment for ways to achieve that carbon intensity that would be required. Again, it's not probably the only way. It is probably the one that might provide the largest reduction, but we do think that practices, improvements in the production practices for the feedstock is another important calculation. There is also efficiency improvements and other types of technologies that can be adopted on site at the production facilities that also would factor into that overall life cycle assessment.
I would just add that ethanol plant back in my area is working with a group of farmers, again, to get that carbon intensity score down. And they're using tillage practices, cover crops, for example, and fertilizer placements. So there are ways to reduce that carbon score, which is key to this process. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the packet here, the sustainability analysis, and it mentions something like regenerative ag practices. So I'm curious to see, what do you guys define as regenerative ag?
Go ahead, answer the question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Vang. So the terminology that we tend to use a little bit more at Minnesota Corn is around like soil health and some of the specific types of practices that would be implemented. Regenerative agriculture overall just, I think, speaks to being able to have those resources available in the future. It's another offshoot of sustainability as a definition. But we don't have an internal sort of organizational definition for regenerative agriculture. We tend to talk a little bit more in soil health, but in particular, given that we represent corn farmers, a lot of it is focused on fertilizer production practices and efficiency of fertilizer.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, soil health practices has been something that we've been talking quite a bit for the past couple of years in this committee. And I know that Minnesota has taken leadership on how we can improve on soil health. I do hope that as we continue to talk about sustainability and how can we continue to improve our farm practices, that we continue to hone on what is actually regenerative ag, what does it mean to support biodiversity, support and ensure clean water and water quality. So I hope that as we have more of the discussion, that regenerative ag has more concrete metric rather than just something that is vaguely defined of improving soil health.
Thanks for your comments. Any other questions? Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, and this could apply to the soybean guys too at some point, but I'm curious. We're making SAF. SAF out of this, there's going to be a byproduct, right? A feedstock of some type, more soybean meal, whether it's camelina. So we have to feed that at some point, right? To animals, I would assume, which generate manure. So if we're talking about regenerative agriculture, just in a general sense, closing the loop, could you comment on how much feedstock you could see just across the board if let's say we just did Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport alone. I'm curious if there's any numbers, and maybe somebody else can answer this question, but how much soybean meal, how much dried distillers grains, how much, what kind of feedstocks will we be generating? In my head, quickly, I was doing camelina on 1 million acres. Is it roughly 700,000 tons of meal? That's what I get in my head. But I'm just curious, you're going to have to feed that to something, and I'm assuming the need for more livestock in Minnesota is what I'm getting towards. And the fact that we'd have more manure produced, and if we're going to talk about true regenerative ag, we'd be talking about spreading more manure in Minnesota, not less. Could you comment on that?
Ms. Billick.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Chair Anderson and Representative Burkle. So the production of sustainable aviation fuel would still have probably a common co-product that current corn ethanol production has, which is distillers' dry grains, and that gets fed to livestock. So that, as far as an estimate on the quantity of DDGs from meeting like the Delta Airline goals at Minneapolis would require a little bit of calculation. But I think you also raised an important point, which is the use of manure in helping to also help reduce carbon emissions. And the assessment that we had done, in addition to looking at the efficient use of fertilizer, another thing that helped to drive down those carbon emissions in the overall production practice for raising the feedstock was the utilization of manure as a nitrogen source for fertilizer.
No further questions. Thank you, Ms. Billick. Next up, we have Joe Smedtak from the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. Mr. Smedtak, identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Joe Smentek. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, a membership organization with about 3,000 Minnesota soybean farmers as our membership. The Minnesota Soybean Growers Association is excited about being a member of the SAF Hub and the opportunity SAF presents. We were one of the original funders of Dr. Weiss's work on pennycress and camelina. Excited to see a crop that could be grown as a cover crop and have that value added to our farmers. We're excited to see the PUC's decision on those carbon pipelines in the state of Minnesota to also add that as a valuable feedstock to the state portfolio for the SAF Hub. In Minnesota, the soybean crop is valued at about $5.2 billion for the marketing year 22 to 23. That is pre any value added, so any animal agriculture, anything else, just straight up the number, the amount of value that that brings to the state. So it would end up being exponentially more with the number of companies and animal agriculture we have in the state. That is unlike a lot of other states that have some of these policies that encourage some of these fuels. Less than, you know, we have more than Illinois, we have more than California that have some of these low carbon fuel standards. So while we were very excited about these opportunities, we have very similar concerns to Chair Hansen about making sure we're getting what we're getting for some of these things. These opportunities for pennycress camelina, the opportunities for the used cooking oils as feedstocks that you've heard have a lower carbon intensity, that is because much of the carbon intensity is borne by the corn and soy oil as quote-unquote virgin oils in those systems. So we are paying a penalty for that pennycress and camelina. If they were not grown as a cover crop, those alternative crops would have to pay that themselves. They would not have such a great CI score. So this is part of a system. It needs to continue to be part of a system. And if the committee is going to go forward and do these types of practices and do these policies that encourage this production, it is very important that we don't make the same mistakes other states did, where we penalize one of the feedstocks unfairly at the cost of the other. We have the opportunity in this state. We're in a very unique position to use the Minnesota State Agriculture Water Certification Program and Farm Service Agency data to, instead of counting every acre and penalizing Minnesota's farmers for an indirect land use change that happened in Indonesia, in Brazil, somewhere else in the world, we can look at direct land use change and tweak the GREET model to do that. Other states haven't done that. We've seen recently in California virgin palm oil coming into California from Indonesia, which is it's virgin palm oil from deforested rainforest land that the people are taking advantage of those tax credits. So setting up a system to make sure that kind of fraud isn't perpetrated is key. We will have the biggest bang for our buck if we are growing this camelina as a cover crop, crushing it in the state, processing it in the state, and not shipping it all around. If we are shipping Brazilian soybeans to China, crushing it there, bringing it back here as what we've been called barely used cooking oil, we have just heard recently from a company that has been in China and seen facilities where they're frying a handful of potato chips in soy oil from Brazil, sending it back to California as used cooking oil, and taking advantage of these giant credits. So it is very important that we watch these unintended consequences of these policies. and make sure we're protecting the corn and soybean growers of the state, because without them, the system will not work. We will not get to the volumes that we need to do the carbon reduction, and we can work with the Ag Water Certification Program and other soil health practices to lower the CI score. Already in Minnesota, we know that indirect land use score is very exaggerated for Minnesota farms, as we are, according to USDA, losing farmland year after year in Minnesota. Thank you for letting me be a part of this and share my concerns about this policy, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thanks, Mr. Smentek. Any questions? Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Smentek, I just was reading a BBC article today, and in Britain it sounded like they were using garbage as part of their sustainable aviation fuel, but it turned out that most of it was coming from cooking oil, which exactly as you said was coming from palm trees. And so this integrity chain that has to be clear in terms of where the sources are, that it's really actually sustainable.
Yes, absolutely,
Chair Anderson,
absolutely. That is, you know, a big concern. The government in Indonesia even recently admitted and put out a warning to other countries that what they are getting as used cooking oil out of Indonesia is virgin palm oil. They don't have companies that are capturing used cooking oil to the scale that we do here, which should incentivize and should play into the SAF Hub's plan, and should be a part of the regulations that come out, that we are incentivizing Minnesota feedstocks, Minnesota processing, Minnesota use. Representative Burkle has a question about the meal with these pennycress and camelina as well, if I could address that. I don't know the exact amount that comes out of the pennycress and camelina. It's less than soybeans, so it's not as much. But the soybean crush in the United States and in Minnesota is still driven by animal agriculture. It's 80% of the makeup of soybean is the meal, 20% is the oil. Of that 20%, the 40% of that is human consumption, 60% is what we have left over and what we created the biodiesel industry to use. It was a drag on the meal market. It was something we had to landfill before. That is held, even as these SAF markets grow and renewable hydrocarbon diesel and some of those other things have grown. We haven't seen a lot of crush come online simply for the oil, primarily because of policies that have hampered the use of it. As far as, you know, California has a cap, the Illinois soybean has a cap for their SAF credit of soybean oil that can go into it. So those types of things have depress some of that, so that hasn't been a huge issue yet, but it is definitely a concern. And our soy checkoff is looking at other ways to use those meal, whether it is in a fertilizer form or other products that could be used to help deal with that if that issue arises.
Thanks, Mr. Smentek.
Thank you.
Seeing no questions, next up will be Brian Werner from the Minnesota Biofuels Association. Identify yourself, sir.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Brian Werner, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. As we've already heard, the greenhouse gas emissions associated with air travel already comprise 3% of total U.S. emissions, and that figure is expected to double by 2050. Because demand for flying is increasing and air travel is a hard to electrify portion of the transportation sector, airlines are increasingly looking at SAF as a promising near-term decarbonization option. There are currently 11 ASTM-approved SAF production pathways that utilize a variety of feedstocks. And to be clear, we will need all of them if we are going to meet the SAF Grand Challenge goals of producing 3 billion gallons by 2030 and 35 billion gallons by 2050. Of these feedstock options, Minnesota-produced ethanol stands out for three main reasons. Number one, our farmers and rural communities have already successfully built a statewide renewable fuel sector with existing production of 1.4 billion gallons of ethanol and 460 million pounds of corn oil last year. Number two, ethanol producers have established infrastructure systems, including transportation networks via truck and rail, and energy networks and power generation and distribution. And number three, Ethanol produced in Minnesota has a low carbon intensity and is on track to be net zero by 2050. Studies from the U.S. Department of Energy have noted that SAF made from cornstarch ethanol is already 20 to 25% less carbon intensive than petroleum-based jet fuel, and SAF made from distillers' corn oil is capable of offering a 70% reduction. It is for these reasons that ethanol-to-jet pathway has been identified as one of the most prominent to likely achieve significant volumes of SAF in the near term, and is expected to be more than 90% of SAF production in 2030, along with hydroprocessed esters and fatty acids, or HEFA. Ethanol-to-jet is both a near-term solution and a springboard for long-term development of the SAF industry in our state. But we know that there's more work to do to get there. The members of the Minnesota Biofuels Association have committed to greenhouse gas emission reductions of 70% by 2030 and 100% by 2050, which will be critical in achieving the necessary 50% threshold relative to fossil jet fuel to gain eligibility as SAF. We are taking action to further reduce the carbon intensity of ethanol, first at the plants through lower carbon industrial processes and lower carbon energy inputs like renewable natural gas and wind and solar generation. Second, by working with our corn farmer partners to incentivize regenerative conservation practices that increase soil organic carbon and reduce commercial fertilizer usage. To be successful, farmers and ethanol producers will need effective and durable policies that enable them to access and utilize these low-carbon and zero-carbon technologies, as well as more consistent timelines for receiving the permits necessary to install them. We're enthusiastic about SAF because it offers a robust market opportunity to economically boost farmers in rural communities while providing substantial environmental benefits and a clear path towards achieving our state's climate goals. As the aviation sector increasingly looks for solutions to reduce the environmental impact of flying, Minnesota-grown and processed renewable fuels like ethanol and ethanol co-products like corn oil are ready to fully participate in meeting the challenge. We look forward to working with you to get us there.
Thanks, Mr. Warner. Questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious on the impact that the Inflation Reduction Act had on SAF production in general.
Yep. So the
Mr. Warner, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Chair Anderson, Representative Frederick, the Sustainable Aviation Fuel had a tax credit through the Inflation Reduction Act known as 40B. That was for 2 years, 2023 and 2024, which was then folded into the 45Z tax credit, which we saw guidance from the U.S. Treasury Department and from USDA right before the inauguration. And I think there is concern and questions about how the new Congress will implement those tax credits and if they will potentially be modified or rolled back through tax legislation that may be considered this year federally. So that's certainly a concern for the industry about whether or not those tax credits will be available from the federal side.
Representative?
Mr. Chair, thank you. So from a, I don't know what you call it, boots on the ground perspective or however you want to look at it, if those tax credits are rolled back, how would that impact Minnesota? How would that impact farmers here in the state?
Mr. Warner?
Chair Anderson, Representative Frederick. SAF right now is anywhere from 3 to 4 times more expensive than traditional jet fuel. And so in order to make up the difference economically, those tax credits are critical. And so there's certainly concern that without those tax credits being available, that it may be more challenging, but not completely impossible. So it is something that we are certainly, we're not totally pessimistic about the opportunity there, but I think it is an important piece of the puzzle.
Any follow-up? Thank you.
Mr. Warner, thank you. And again, hang around if there's any further questions. Next up, Ann Schwagel, Vice President of the Minnesota Farmers Union. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Ann Schwagel. I am a farmer near Browns Valley, Minnesota in Big Stone County. We run a diversified grain operation where we raise corn, soybeans, wheat, and a new winter oil seed, winter camelina. I farm on 585 acres, we added some this year, that we own and rent and we still feel small for this type of production and in our area of the state. So we're always looking for ways to remain competitive and creative on our operation. I'm also honored to serve as the Vice President of Minnesota Farmers Union. We're a grassroots, membership-driven organization that has represented family farmers like myself since we were founded in 1918. To add to this conversation, I want to talk about why, as a grain farmer, who's still newer in my career, that I'm excited about sustainable aviation fuel. In particular, what it would mean for my farm. I'll start by talking about our work-growing winter camelina, a crop that's being developed by the University of Minnesota Forever Green Initiative. We plant this winter oil seed in the fall after we harvest our other crops, and it is important to us for two reasons. First, this crop allows us to keep our soil continuously covered throughout the year, protecting the soil from wind and water erosion over our harsh Minnesota winters in early spring. We don't want to lose the soil, and having winter camelina and a third crop or traditional cover crops, which we also employ, helps to keep that in place. Second, it's another crop that we can market to help our farm cash flow and support our family. The camelina on my farm that we harvested was crushed, and then the oil from it is refined and used locally at Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport as a drop-in replacement for petroleum-based jet fuels. We feel like this is a win-win-win opportunity. We've got a new market and are improving our farm's economic viability. We're protecting our environment, and we're helping to lower the carbon intensity of a difficult-to-decarbonize sector of the transportation industry. Beyond winter camelina, we're also continually looking for and experimenting with other ways to increase efficiency and lower the carbon intensity of the other crops that we grow on our farm. We utilize low and no-till production, cover crops, and precision agricultural practices like gridding and variable rate application of fertilizers. It is also my hope that a growing market for SAF will help us continue to reduce the farm's impact on the environment while also seeing some of the market return for that work. To close, as a Minnesotan and a farmer, I'm excited to see that our state is leading in the development of sustainable aviation fuel because of what it could mean for my farm. We're glad to support the continuation of the tax credits and other incentives that ensure that we maintain a leading role in the launch of this growing market. And for our farm, it is really important that the integrity of is ensured for domestic feedstocks to protect Minnesota's family farmers. Thank you, Chair Anderson, for having this meeting, and I'll stand for questions.
Thanks, Ms. Schwagel. Any questions from members? Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Schwagel. What's the fertilizer recommendations for winter camelina? When is it applied? What's the pounds per acre?
Sure.
And then what's the pest pressure and treatment?
Ms. Schwagel?
Chair Anderson, Chair Hansen, we fertilize it very similar to what we do for our oat crops when we're growing oats. So less fertilizer, 60 pounds. So my friends at the University of Minnesota can confirm that. About 60 pounds of nitrogen per acre. And then as far as pest control, we haven't had any pest issues. The beauty of it is that it is really competitive for spring weed control. So it reduces the need for herbicide use on the farm.
Chair Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, how about deer pressure?
Ms. Schwagel.
Chair Anderson, Chair Hansen. I don't live in southeast Minnesota and have the same kind of deer pressure that some of our other family farmers do. The only deer pressure that I can talk about is in my garden, where I really wish deer season was year-round.
Thank you. And I would add that obviously fertilizer use for camelina and oats is less than for corn, but your yields are also correspondingly less. So corn is a high-value, high-yielding crop that does take fertilizer. No doubt about it. With no further questions, thank you, Ms. Schwagel. Next up, we have Rick Horton from the Minnesota Forest Industries Association.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and committee members. My name is Rick Horton. I'm the Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries. We're a trade association for the big primary wood-consuming mills in the state. We make all the products that you use every day that are made out of wood. we can fly airplanes with wood. Seems like a unique concept. We've been talking about ag here all morning, but creating the infrastructure to do that would be beneficial for our forests. It'd be helpful for our loggers and for the forest products industry, and would help reduce carbon emissions in the transportation sector. Wood is renewable and sustainable. There's an abundance of residual material available from the mills, from tops and limbs after a logging operation, and from salvage after blowdowns, fires, and things like that. I believe the last time they measured it was 2022. 2.6 million green tons were available. About 1.5 million green tons had other markets, so there's an availability of about 1.1 million green tons of wood material in the system. Removing some of that from the forest improves forest health, it increases climate resilience, it improves visual quality, and it increases forest regeneration rates. Representative Hansen's point, there are site-level forest management guidelines in place to ensure that we leave enough behind for soil health in the forest, for wildlife habitat, to reduce runoff, and the like. And most of our public and industrial forest land is enrolled in third-party certification practices. These third parties, like Sustainable Forestry Initiative or Forest Stewardship Council, set standards and objectives that we follow, and we're audited to make sure we're following those, and those protect ecological, economic, and social sustainable factors. And then those practices are put in place by our highly trained logging workforce. Our loggers undergo about as much annual training as probably more than most attorneys. Trees themselves are carbon vacuums, if you think about it. They use sunlight and nutrients and convert atmospheric carbon into wood that's stored in the tree until the tree dies or burns up. Collectively, the forest absorbs more carbon than is emitted, which makes the forest sector the only one in the state that is, the only economic sector that is carbon neutral. And our forests absorb 15% of the carbon that's emitted from all the other sources out there. Now, the demand for SAF is high now and growing exponentially as airlines like Delta work to reduce their carbon footprint. Meeting that demand will require all available feedstocks and technologies, as you have heard. Wood fiber offers one of the best options to quickly reduce carbon intensity. Because of the carbon absorbing and storing power of our forests, the carbon intensity of wood-based SAF is significantly lower than conventional jet fuel, with studies indicating a potential CI reduction of up to 80%. As you've heard, you need 50% just to call it SAF, and wood definitely has some of the lowest CI scores out there. Now, certainly there are concerns and barriers to developing wood to SAF systems, but they're not insurmountable. From our perspective, we need to ensure that the feedstocks are waste material. MFI's member companies, combined with loggers, truckers, and the secondary wood products manufacturers, are the fifth largest industry in the state. We provide 68,000 jobs, produce $7.3 billion in economic benefit. We need to ensure that we can serve this new demand for wood without jeopardizing existing industries by competing for raw materials. And like many other sectors, we struggle with workforce shortages in our sector. As the new sector grows, we need to make joint efforts to retain and grow the logging workforce, the trucking workforce, and industrial employment opportunities. So the technology to fly airplanes with wood does exist, but it needs to be scaled up to show its true potential. You're seeing a few phase two projects out there. There's some operations on the West Coast that are actually producing SAF from wood, but it's not new technology. They were producing diesel with wood back in World War II. But it's the economics that always triggers things, and we have to work on the economics of it. So reducing carbon in the transportation sector is an important goal for addressing climate change. The commitment of carriers like Delta Airlines to that goal is driving urgency and spurring innovation. It will take all hands on deck to get there, and we believe there's a strong place for wood in the equation. And in your packets, you'll also see a handout called Wheels Up with Wood with some of the facts and figures around it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Hoffman, thanks. Any questions? Representative Agbeje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the testifier. I guess I just have a little bit of some clarifying questions. You said that for this industry, you would want to make sure that it's waste product from wood that's coming. So just to be clear, does that mean are there other operations that are actually cutting trees to provide materials for SAF?
Mr. Horton.
Chair Anderson and Representative, when I talk waste in the woods, we have mill waste. So there's sawdust, bark, things like that at the mills. We have markets for some of that, but not all. And then in the woods, we use the round trunk of the tree. And you got all the tops and limbs left over that lay in the woods and rot down. Some of that is required and necessary for wildlife habitat, for soil health, and that sort of thing. But we have, you know, this isn't the first time we've used wood. There was a time when XL Energy had a very large wood biomass energy production facility in Becker at Benson. And a lot of that material was being picked up, chipped, and shipped off to generate electricity. That has since closed. But we've shown that we have the capability to remove that material and transport that material to a market.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just kind of if you could explain a little bit further kind of what you mean or, you know, these site-level forest management guidelines and the sustainability aspect there, I guess, and just ensuring that our forests are still, you know, doing what they need to do and being that carbon sink that you talked about and kind of how that matches up with increasing input for SAF as well.
Mr. Horton.
Chair and Representative. So the guidelines were developed by the Minnesota Forest Resources Council to ensure that we are sustainably managing our forests. These were developed back in the late 90s and have been in place for a number of years. We just got done with a third iteration of revising them to make sure that they reflect current science and new science. And they have many different elements to them, but they talk about biodiversity, soil health, water quality, cultural resources, visual resources, just spans the whole gamut. We're very proud of how we manage our forests here in Minnesota, and we got well out ahead of the sustainability curve.
Thank you. Had a question on this side from whom? Oh, Representative Jacobs, sorry, I didn't see you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. So just really quickly with the amount of emerald ash borer that we're dealing with, is there a connection there that any of that wood could be potentially utilized for potential fuel at some point?
Mr. Horton.
Chair Anderson, Representative Jacob. Yes, certainly that dead material could be made into SAF. What we're seeing right now is the big pulse of material in the greater metropolitan area as our urban forests have, with ash in them, have died, and there's a huge abundance of that material. That's a temporary thing. I think we're going to work through that as the ash die and are cut down and replaced, and currently a lot of that is being burned for electricity and steam at District Energy. But up north, we've got a million acres of nearly pure black ash stands, potentially a billion cords of wood. And if this EAB ever gets into that, it's going to cause some huge ecological problems. But certainly this would be an outlet for that material. We've also got 660,000 acres of balsam fir dead and dying from spruce budworm. And that's primarily up in the Arrowhead region, Superior National Forest. But it's highly flammable, and it's just we don't have markets for it. We have a million acres of tamarack that's dead and dying from eastern larch beetle. So there are these big forest health issues, and without markets for those materials, we can't really address the health issues. So this does give us a new opportunity to manage for healthier forests.
Good question, Representative. Seeing no further questions, Mr. Horton, thank you for your presentation today. And thanks to all of our testifiers. And if anybody else has questions or anybody in the audience care to comment on this topic of sustainable aviation fuel. Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair, just on that, I did receive some texts that there were some folks who may have wanted to testify but weren't aware that there would be testimony. They thought it was a presentation. So maybe you and I can discuss that later.
Thank you. With that, we'll move on to the second item on today's agenda, the First District Milk Association's presentation about their situation. We have 25 minutes, so we should have plenty of time to hear your presentation. Welcome to today's committee, and Mr. Bob Hoffman is whom I have on my list, so go ahead, Mr. Hoffman, identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Hoffman. I'm the President and CEO of First District Association, based out of Litchfield, Minnesota.
Speak loudly.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee for having us. I'd like to give you a little bit of background on First District. We're a dairy cooperative based here in Minnesota. We really go from state line to state line. We have approximately 570 family farm owners of the cooperative that cover across 46 counties that produce roughly about 8.5 million pounds of milk a day, or if you look at a total of about 3 billion pounds of milk a year. And a large portion of that is processed in the plant that the farmers that own the cooperative operate in Litchfield, Minnesota. Out of the 570 family owners, the average farm size is roughly 300 cows. I would say that probably 70% or greater is under 150 cows. And then we go up on that other 30%. There's a small percentage that represents probably 15% of the milk from the larger farms. We have approximately 500 employees in the cooperative. That's both operating at the plant and hauling the milk from the farms to the market, to the plant, or some milk that we do market into the cities, into the bottling milk. We are the largest dairy processing plant in the state of Minnesota, probably the newest state-of-the-art infrastructure, which has been part of a plan that our farmers have had over the last 10 years to remodernize the facility from a food safety standpoint, from an infrastructure, and really from a core value of making sure there's a market there for further generations. So in 2021, we commissioned new facilities that was a part of that 10-year plan, which was brand new buildings and brand new equipment that our farmers have invested in. And that was all part of a 10-year plan to get to 2021, which all started 10 years prior with wastewater. And that's the topic that we're here in front of you guys today over. The initial part of the project, our members invested roughly $46 million in projects into the wastewater infrastructure operated by the city of Litchfield to be ready for the expansion and the new buildings to be able to operate. That was the first step that was taken and the first investment. Roughly $200 million later in 2021 is when the new plants came on in steps and fully commissioned and operated. So quite a vision there that, again, started with the basics of wastewater, then went through up brick and mortar, and then equipment technology. The plant in Litchfield, Minnesota produces approximately 800,000 pounds of cheese a day, and it also produces about 100 million pounds of whey protein and lactose powders a year annually. And a little over 60% of that, those powders of protein and lactose, is exported globally outside of the country, and those powders are used primarily in infant formula, both domestic and export, and then also confectionery products like Johnsonville Brats, Doritos, nacho cheese Doritos, different Mars candy products like that across. I'm very confident if you open up any of your cupboards or go into a store, there's a good chance that there's an ingredient that come out of Minnesota, produced by Minnesota dairy farmers, whether they were in Meeker County, Litchfield, or on one side of the state, north or south of the state. You know, we're a co-op, and the difference between a private organization and a co-op, I'm sure you're all aware of that, but there's basically one, I call it one bucket of money. It's we bring the milk off the farm for our owners, and we market that milk, and we cover the cost to market it. And we the biggest portion goes in the mailbox for that farmer once a month to pay them for the milk so they can continue operating. And the remainder of that is held back to keep the lights on and make sure everything is in place. And then hopefully there's some at the end of the year to reinvest back into the co-op and do exactly what we've done with the new infrastructure we've built. That total investment over that 10-year period has highly leveraged First District and quite honestly put us in, so we took the position to be able to do that. And for the time being, it's going to take some while to pay down that debt. The issue that's come up is once we started that facility up and working and partnered with the city of Litchfield, the wastewater facility was not able to handle what we have started up under compliance. And it is out of compliance, and we are currently under a schedule of compliance with the PCA in the state of Minnesota and under a timeline to have that resolved and fixed. We went into agreement to do that, and we took steps and up a project to complete that was a much less burden on taxpayers by building a pretreatment facility, designing and building a pretreatment facility that can handle that. We, as going through the last legislative cycle, we felt like the support was going to come through. And with our schedule compliance, we did break ground and start that project. However, we're in a position now where we're looking at making the major investments and funding is a serious issue, both for us and the city to be able to complete that. And that's, again, that's the reason why we're here in front of you today. The project, in big picture, really is some of you guys have all have a pamphlet in your packet. To fix the problem or to resolve it, it is building a digester on site in partnership with the city. It will actually be built on the city's land. And that digester and the pretreatment pieces with it will address and resolve the current compliance problem that we're in today, which is primarily a BOD issue and the tightening of further parameters regarding phosphorus and nitrogen. There will be more steps that need to be taken as those continue to tighten, but that puts us in the compliance perspective that we are going to have to get in. With the timeline we have, if we do not reach that, the consequences of that are to scale back production and volume into that plant. And with the size and scale of that plant, the initial scale back would be roughly a 50% reduction in manufacturing and volume of milk coming into that site. Mr. Chair, that's the bulk of my initial presentation. I moved here pretty quick, and I would like to introduce the two individuals sitting next to me if I could. I'd be more than happy to let them introduce themselves.
Very good. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chair, committee members. I am Tim Shrupp. I'm a fifth-generation dairy farmer. I've been sending milk to this co-op for bars for about 50 years. I'm happy you were here to hear us out on this, and we truly value that it's going to be a valuable part of our infrastructure for years to come.
Thank you. Ma'am?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Megan Shrupp, my husband Tim and I are dairy farmer owners, and I myself am a cattle veterinarian. We own and operate Next Gen Dairy. Next Gen Dairy is a third generation family dairy farm located in Painesville, Minnesota. We milk 1,200 Jerseys and farm about 1,500 acres to produce all the forages for the dairy. And our milk ships to First District Association, where it is made mostly into cheddar cheese. In addition to being dairy farmers, Tim and I are chairs of our Young Cooperators Board at the co-op at First District. And this year, Tim Shrupp and I are serving as chairpersons of the National Young Cooperators Advisory Board.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions from members or comments?
I would just, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with former Representative Erdahl, we visited this location several times and on the bonding tour, but did I hear correctly you've broke ground? Or so what can be bondable if you've started construction and what is not bondable in the project?
Mr. Hoffman.
Chair Anderson Hansen. With the schedule of compliance agreement that we put in place to continue operating, we had no choice but to move forward to meet a timeline. The funding for that is definitely a challenge, working through that, and the cost up front, depending on that bonding, were decisions we had to make to go ahead and break ground. From a overall cost perspective, we found that it was going to be much lower cost if we partnered with the city and built the pretreatment system on the city's property with First District operating the pretreatment facility and building and owning the equipment put on the pretreatment facility. From a bonding perspective, that's going to create several challenges. For that reason, we have asked for direct support to First District as we partner with the city and state to be able to put in that wastewater infrastructure to resolve the issue.
Chair Hansen, any further questions? Mr. Hoffman, what would the ask of the state, in your opinion, to get this project moving into fruition?
Chair Anderson, the current ask, and I believe there's a current bill that is on the Senate side, is an ask of $10 million, which is the same ask that was in the prior legislative session that did not close in the last 15 seconds. That is the minimum of what we're going to be able to do, plus other financing that we're able to get and other support that we can get to make that project happen. We appreciate you guys hearing us out. We appreciate what you guys do, and we appreciate the support of this committee in reviewing that request. It's really important that we can get this resolved and that we can put in the right pretreatment or the right wastewater infrastructure, partnering with the residents in Litchfield and the city and the state, and put this issue to rest.
Yeah. We certainly understand the situation, and the hindsight is 2020, of course, but it should have been in that bonding bill last year. But it wasn't, so we have to move ahead and somehow come up with it in another fashion. One thing I'd just like to clarify again, you say you have 570 dairy members and take in milk from 46 counties, is that correct?
Yes. Yes, we stretch across 46 total counties from state line to state line, clear up from Duluth out west to out past Marshall to Windham, clear down the southeast corner. We have a large portion of milk down in the southeast as well. So we stretch across. Again, if you look at our farm size, to me, this is the reason why I work for dairy farmers. There's nothing better than a cooperative in today's environment and commodity environments. You know, our farm families are not corporate entities. They're not what you see in large or what we see out west that, quite frankly, Minnesota is competing against. So when you're able to pull farm families' milk, whether they have 30 cows, 80 cows, 200 cows, 2,000 cows, pulling that milk together through the cooperative is how we can make sure that we can be competitive as long as we have the infrastructure and we can run the operation to be able to do that.
Thank you. And I'm not an expert on dairy processing, but from what I've read and heard, Minnesota's capacity is at about 100% right now. Is that correct?
That's correct. And unfortunately, there's some processing capacity that is very aged, and will have to either reinvest or replace. And you know, from a dairy farmer perspective, especially in the southeast part of the state and the eastern part of the state, we've seen those assets shutter and not be replaced. So from our cooperative perspective, that's why the 10-year vision was put in place, to make sure that our facility in Litchfield could be a central portion of the state and be able to service and support the market and region.
Ma'am, go ahead. And say Mr. your name again for the record, please.
Ms. Megan Shrupp. And if Mr. Chairman, if I could just add to that, as a young dairy farmer, third generation, and thinking forward even to moving our family dairy farm onto the fourth generation, many of us young farmers are really going to be tasked with the challenge of ensuring a milk market going into the future to continue these family farms in Minnesota. So it's really important that we have a modernized plant and a plant that will be able to take our milk into the future for us to continue farming.
Thank you, Ms. Schrupp. And again, you mentioned a possible 50% scale back. Those of you that milk the cows, you can't ask the cows to cut back to give half the milk for a while. So it's really imperative that you have a market, a steady market. And I would say this is an urgent need for the state to look into this and to provide some help. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe nonpartisan staff could help. Is there a dairy checkoff? I know we had the Got Milk campaign. I think that was federal. Is there a state checkoff?
Ms. Holmbeck? Let's go to research staff first. Or no?
Oh, I don't know. I can look into that for you, though.
Okay. Mr. Hoffman?
Mr. Chair, there is a checkoff program. There's a national checkoff program and then a regional checkoff. The checkoff funds are all dairy farmers are paying into that fund per 100 weight of milk or 100 pounds of milk they produce. And then that budget is split between the region and the national level for marketing.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could that possibly be used for appropriation bonds as a source of revenue to come in to provide bridge funding?
Mr. Hoffman?
Mr. Chair, Anderson and Hansen, unfortunately not. Those are marketing funds, promotional funds, that cannot be allocated to one entity or other entities for capital spending.
Have a few minutes left. Mr. Savior, do you have a? No, I guess not. One final comment then, in how it relates to bonding. Since your project has started, that makes it ineligible for GO bonding. Is that correct, Mr. Hoffman?
I'm learning the Mr. Chair, I'm learning the technicalities of this, but that's my understanding. Okay. We got, you know, in a unique position to where we, you know, again, working with the PCA and not getting ourselves into an issue and of shutting it down and putting our farmers out of business, we had to take those steps. Again, yep. We were under the understanding of the last legislative cycle, how that was moving forward, and we had to take that step.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments from any members? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Restrictions on the use of checkoff dollars are probably, I mean, if nonpartisan staff could look up if those are provided by law or by policy. If they're provided by law, they can be changed by us. And then finally, a question. Mr. Chair, you had mentioned something about there were dairy dollars that were appropriated last time that may have not have been expended because of a lack of a farm bill. Do we know how much those are?
That amount is $4 million. And that has been under a lot of discussion. Anything further? If not, go ahead, Mr. Hoffman.
I would just like to thank the individuals that eat pizza with a lot of cheese on and the mac and cheese that support our dairy farmers.
I bet you had a good day yesterday. Yeah. With that, a lot of good questions today, and again, we'll be meeting again at 1 o'clock on Wednesday. With that, meeting is adjourned.